People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. This week I went to the opening of the Agatha Christie play that has just opened at Theatre on the Bay, Peter Turin's Theatre on the Bay, called Black Coffee, with quite a cast, and with Alan Committee as Hercule Poirot. In the cast, as Captain Hastings, is Ashley Dowds, and I've invited Ashley into the studio to talk about this amazing play. I'm a huge Agatha Christie fan, and so any Agatha Christie just bewilders me. And you've had your fair amount of Agatha Christie, haven't you, Ashley?
Yeah.
You were in The Mousetrap.
I was in The Mousetrap, twice.
Who did it in The Mousetrap?
in The Mousetrap.
The Mousetrap.
I was in it initially with Roger Dwyer directing way back.
That's a name from the past.
And Malcolm Terry, amongst many others in the cast. And that was, I'm trying to think of the year, and I can't. But it was a long time ago. And then Alan directed the next one 10 years later.
The Mousetrap.
The Mousetrap.
Alan Swerdlow, you mean, the director of this play?
Alan Swerdlow directed The Mousetrap. And we went to Hong Kong with that. And I played the same role. I played the detective in that role, in that production. It's been great coming back to Agatha Christie with Alan, especially, because he just invests it with so much.
Yes, I remember that last one he did here quite recently, a prosecution.
Witness to the Prosecution.
Witness to the Prosecution, where Alan also famously adds his own touches here and there, which apparently he's done in this. So I was trying to spot them at the opening night, and I managed to spot a few.
Well, what did you spot? Because on the table, there's a model of an atom. I don't know if that made any significance.
It did. And behind the table was the board with the famous equation on that was stolen.
Ernest Rutherford's formula, which is quite amazing. Because in the play, the formula is stolen and it has to be returned. And there's a link between the theft of the document and the killer, obviously.
Ah, okay. We must be very careful not to give it away.
No, we must.
Right. But the amazing thing is, as Alan says, that Agatha Christie was involved, might have even heard Rutherford speak, and was involved with all this at that time, 1928, when she wrote this.
Fascinating, And I mean, there's a sentence that's used by the sort of Rutherford character, Sir Claude, whose house we're in, for this murder mystery. And he says, truth is not horrible, it's just interesting. Whereas before we could kill thousands, we can now kill tens of thousands.
It's a bit chilling as well, isn't it?
Because he's working on atomic theory.
Yeah.
He was the first person to discover the fact that the atom was quite spacious, that materials are not solid, and that, you've got all this empty space in between.
It is fascinating, and for her, Agatha Christie, to have brought this in to this play adds a special amount of tension, don't you think, to the whole sort of structure and story.
It does. She was writing this just before the Second World War, too, which was quite... And the other point is that she worked in the University Hospital in London and learnt all about poisons.
She got it from?
Okay.
We must not give too much away, Ashley, but... One of the things that I found interesting was, and you're going to have to talk about your colleague now, which I hope you don't mind, is Alan Committee's extraordinary role as Hercule Poirot. And Alan Swerdlow, the director, said to me he was determined to take Alan out of Alan. He didn't want people to think it was Alan. And I think he succeeded because Alan is completely different in every way. He's even wearing something that makes him quite a lot fatter.
He's got this huge cushion that he straps onto himself, which is it's quite an achievement, actually, to be able to swagger around in that thing all night. It's really
hot. What I was thinking while I was watching it, actually, is I'm so used to you in quite sort of leading roles. And as Hastings, it must have been quite tricky, and I even said this to Alan, you're kind of subservient, and yet you're not, because you do so much with your face and body. that you suddenly become very integral, which, of course, you need to be, as Hastings.
Well, you know, there are a couple of things there. I mean, firstly, I want to just talk about Allan Committee, because I don't think many people realize how immersed he is in theatre as a whole. People know Allan Committee as a stand-up comedian, yes, and he's phenomenal as a comedian. But he's incredibly invested in theatre, per se. And, you know, he's a fund of knowledge when you come to understanding what's going on worldwide in theatre, mm-hmm, and what roles are happening, what roles he'd love to play. So, you know, you combine that with the kind of timing and the ability for comedy that he has. And I think you can see the comedy. You can't completely take it away, because that's an important element, especially in the play between Hastings and Poirot.
Yes.
And it's exhilarating. I've got to tell you, it's exhilarating going on that ride with Allan Committee.
I'm sure.
Because it's fast, and it's, and you play off each other. And I think that's, so to answer the other part of the question, how do you stand there and not say as much as the lead? I guess it's about, without becoming all, you know, up your own backside, it's about just being present, really, and just listening. You know, they say most of theater is just listening to what people are actually saying. Mm-hmm. If you're going to stand there stony-faced, then just switch off until you're aligned. It's just ridiculous. So,
I mean, you've got your notebook, as a true Hastings would have.
Yes, yeah.
And you respond, as you said. There's definitely a touch of humor between you and Allan in the course of the evening.
Yeah. No, and I'm really enjoying that.
But I want to come back to that. But as we head towards the first piece of music, which is by Elvis Presley, I just want to remind you, as if you need reminding, of your recent solo role, a one-man show called Elvis Dubisani, which was written by Paul Stavlevski. And that was, I think, different for you completely from anything you've done before.
You know, they say if you want to challenge yourself, you have to scare yourself. And I think this was terrifying, to be offered a solo show and to take that whole journey, because it is, especially in the first couple of weeks where you're not used to being on your own on stage. It is terrifying, but it was such a learning experience. Like, I just learned so much being able to carry a story, the whole arc of a story, just the pacing of it and everything else. And I chose this particular track, CC Rider, because it's the opening of one of Elvis's live performances, and it's one of the most incredibly goosebumply openings that I've ever seen a performer do. And it gave me some energy to get onto the stage. So I played this occasionally before I went on. And a lot of people spoke about Elvis before knowing what it was about as, oh, impersonation. And it really is anything but. It's not, I mean, the character wants to impersonate Elvis, but it's a story, it's a very real story of a man having to confront his past and the effects, the after effects of that happening to him.
What was the Dupasani part? Was that his real name?
Eddie Dupasani, the hints of Paul Slab.
Yeah.
In this, because Eddie grows up in Modderfontein, and Paul did. I actually went on a road trip with Paul. He drove me around Modderfontein, showed me where he used to go and play soccer, and where his dad was a fitter and turner at the dynamite factory. He used to go and work over there. You see the chimney stacks and these old mining houses, these corrugated iron houses where they used to live, and all the characters and personalities that he met over there. And then the family moved to Witbank. We don't say Witbank, we say Witbank, because he was English-speaking in an Afrikaans area. So Eddie Dupasani is a young boy who grows up in this family. The father's Afrikaans, the mother's from England, had come out from England. And at a particular stage of his life, very critical stage of his life, at 16, this major tragedy happens. And in a way, Elvis is the salvation, because he desperately clings to this notion of Elvis and that he can become like Elvis. And one day he believes Elvis is going to visit him. And he goes to a lamppost to have this meeting with Elvis. It doesn't happen. Cut to many years later in his life, and he tries to end it all.
Good grief. And now, of course, you've made us want to see it, those of us who didn't see it.
He comes back 30 years later, and he says, damn it. While it was happening, he switches on the car radio, and it's, is your heart filled with pain? He goes, oh, my God, I've got to go back to Witbank, to that lamppost, because that's where it all started, and that's where he starts confronting it. So it's a tragedy, but it's also redemptive, and it really affects audiences. I mean, it was that was gratifying. to see how story affects people viscerally. Man, it was gratifying.
So we're going to hear Elvis now.
Yeah.
This piece that gives you strength, and it's called CC Rider.
I said CC Rider. Oh, see what you have done. I said CC Rider. Oh, see what you have done. Oh, girl, you made me love you. No, your loving man has gone. Well, what I say? Well, I'm going away, baby. And I won't be back till fall. And I'm going away, baby. And I won't be back till fall. Well, if I find me a good girl, I said, CC Rider. Oh, see what you have done. I said, CC Rider. Oh, see what you have done. My girl, you made me love you. No, you love me. Wait a minute.
Well, there we heard Elvis Presley, and that was called CC Rider, the first choice of my guest on People of Note this week, who's Ashley Dowd, and he's in the play Black Coffee, the Agatha Christie thriller that's on at Theatre on the Bay. But just when you were talking about Elvis Dubisani that you did recently, did you have to do lots of sort of Elvis moves? Was it a very physical show?
I watched a lot of the videos. So, you know, this short scene in the story where he enters a competition and he gets to perform at the Blesbok Community Hall, basically,
yeah.
In Witbank. And his girlfriend, the neighbor, has come to watch. And that's the whole point of him. And so spotlight on Eddie Dubuzzani, who sings not very well. But yes, I watched a lot of the videos and I got some of the moves. So in this particular performance at the Blesbok Park Hall, I managed to carry off a few of those. And the real audience actually do go ballistic,
even though I
sing terribly.
Oh, wow.
But it worked, you know. And Eddie Dubuzzani comes third in the competition because he hates the fact that the first guy got the prize because he yodeled. And Elvis would have died before he yodeled, you know. Yeah. And the second guy who got the prize wore a green tie. I mean, everyone knows Elvis would never, never wear a green tie.
Yes.
And he's sitting morosely all alone at the back of the school hall or the community hall, and his girlfriend appears, and she says, well, if it means anything, I still think you were the best.
Shame. It's a nice bit of poignancy there. Let's get back to Agatha Christie and Black Coffee.
Yeah.
One of the things also that struck me watching it, it's quite a big cast. It's quite a big ensemble cast, isn't it? You've just spoken about how frightening it is to work on your own, and you also spoke about this wonderful interplay with you and Alan, but is a big cast. Did you enjoy that?
It's an amazing experience being back with an ensemble, you know, and we've got such swathe of cast members. There's a whole, from the junior actors just coming into the industry for the first time, actors that have been in the industry for 50 plus years, mm-hmm. you know, and all the traditions and all the snide comments and and all the sarcasm and whatever goes on in the dressing room. Whatever goes on in the dressing room stays in the dressing room,
yes,
basically.
I think that's what I believe.
Anyone that walked in there would be shocked at the level of conversation.
But I'm sure it's very important that you all get on as well.
Yeah, yeah. No, it has been very supportive.
You've got Mike Huff,
yeah,
who's been around for who knows how long.
And you were going to say 100 years.
I was going to.
Yeah.
And Anne Williams, who's not been on stage apparently for a very, very long time. And there she is, looking
there
wonderful.
There she is. Yeah. Fantastic.
Michael Richard.
Yeah.
Diane Simpson, Skooman Smith. It really is quite a cast.
Yeah.
That you sort of interact with and play with.
And as I say, you know, apart from the age range, you've got comedic skills of Mr. Committee. You've got Michael Richards, who could probably take a Boeing out of the sky with the sort of decibels that he puts out from
yes,
himself. You know,
he
could penetrate brick wall.
Yes.
And so he has to keep quiet in the dressing rooms. Otherwise, you'd be able to hear him on stage. But no, it's fantastic. I mean, just to bring that level of performance. Here you've got two Salieris from the show Amadeus sitting next to each other.
Oh,
you know?
Yes.
Committee and Richard.
That's right. That's
right. We're both Salieri in their respective
That's right, in those productions ages ago. Gosh, I didn't think of that, but you're absolutely right. And if I remember, Michael was a very good Salieri. He was, as was Alan.
As was Alan.
Yeah, yeah.
Alan's been nominated for that role, too.
Oh, has he? Oh, good
ladies.
For him.
Yeah.
Good for him. And it's the first time I think he's playing Hercule Poirot, isn't it?
Yeah.
And really relishing it by the looks of things.
Yeah. The whole hog with the hair being shaved and the moustache and everything else.
He was very proud. I remember seeing him a few months ago and saying, why are you growing a moustache? And he said it's for Poirot, and he was hoping it would grow enough so that he could curl up the edges.
Oh, the curls are coming. Yeah.
Which he can, already they sort of there.
Yeah.
Yes. With a play like this, is the script difficult to learn with this constant banter and batter? Is she an easy writer for an actor? Mm.
There's a particular pace to Agatha Christie. If you allow it to ponder too much, it gets bogged down and it becomes boring. So especially the exposition, you've got to do two things. You've got to make sure that the audience are getting the information, the critical information that they need to get. But you also need to move. You need to move quickly.
Yeah.
Because that's just set up.
Yes.
And then you can get into the scenes and the scenes start crackling. You know, if you think of the scenes with the Italian visitor, the mysterious Italian visitor, Carelli.
Yes.
Who encounters Poirot and the two of them crack. It's Michael Richard.
Yes, that there was lovely chemistry between them as well, actually.
Yes. And of course, behind closed doors, when the rest of the suspects are out of sight, it's Poirot and Hastings, Captain Hastings, and their theories about what and who and, and all the rest.
And you even get seduced.
And of course.
You get taken into a garden.
Yes.
And I noticed you came back with lipstick on your cheek.
Got
I hope
to take
your
that
wife
off,
didn't
actually.
Object. Ashley, the story of Agatha Christie, there's a bit of a South African connection there, isn't she? Because she did come here.
Apparently. Now, I've been watching a little bit of David Suchet's documentary, which is on
–
it used to be able to see it on YouTube. I think they've taken it off because there's copyright issues or something. But there was a documentary about – he was tracking Agatha Christie's journeys around the empire. So there was going to be a British Empire exhibition – in 1922, she was invited with her partner to join in this tour to all the dominions. And part of the tour included Cape Town and going up on a train to Rhodesia at the time to go to the falls.
Yes.
So when Agatha Christie came here, I believe she stayed at the Mount Nelson.
I'm sure she must have.
She swam at Musenberg and loved it. She had a little surfboard. Can you believe
I've
it?
I've heard about this surfing thing. Is it true?
Apparently it's true. Apparently you can see pictures. And if you go to Musenberg, there's a plaque. There's one of those historic plaques.
Oh, yes.
I don't know what it says, but she was here.
Good gracious me.
Yeah.
And then she disappeared famously, didn't she?
Yeah, there was a time when her husband was not quite true to the marriage, and she disappeared for 11 days, I believe.
Yeah. And it was quite a mystery.
Yeah.
Even she couldn't have written it. It created such a sensation, didn't it?
Yeah.
Your next piece, Mary Martin singing My Heart Belongs to Daddy, and this is connected with Black Coffee, isn't it?
This is a song that Alan Swerdlow, the director, chose for a little segment where there's a dance.
Yes, a little gramophone.
Bit of a ditty. that happens. And the gramophone is cranked up.
Yes.
And this is what plays.
Okay, so let's listen to Mary Martin, My Heart Belongs to Daddy, and imagine dancing on the stage at Theatre on the Bay.
I used to fall in love with all those boys who call on young Cupid. But now I find I'm more inclined to keep my mind on my duty. For since I've come to care for such a sweet millionaire, while tearing off a game of golf, I may make a play for the caddy. But when I do, I don't follow through, 'cause my heart belongs to Daddy. If I invite a boy some night to dine on my fine Finnan Haddie, I just adore his asking for more, but my heart belongs to Daddy. Yes, my heart belongs to Daddy, so I simply couldn't be bad. Yes, my heart belongs to Daddy. Dad, 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 dad. So I want to warn you, laddie, though I think you're perfectly swell, that my heart belongs to Daddy, and my daddy, he treats us so well. Though other dames at football games may make a play for the Grady, I never dream of making the team, 'cause my heart belongs to Daddy. Yes, my heart belongs to Daddy. Dilly ooby 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 daddy. Yes, my heart belongs to Daddy. Dilly ooby dilly ooby ooby daddy. Daddy, he treats it so well.
Mary Martin there singing that song, My Heart Belongs to Daddy, which if you go and see Black Coffee, which I hope you do, because you're going to love it, you'll see it being danced to on stage. And maybe even the murderer's involved in the dance, or maybe he isn't.
Mm.
I love the guessing. Mm. I was quite wrong last night at the theater when I went to the opening. At interval, you know, we all discussed, no, it must be her. No, definitely it's him. Now, I think because he said that. And anyway, we were all wrong.
I think they're red herrings where we didn't even expect them as a cast.
Exactly. Oh, even the cast.
Yes.
Okay, good grief. I was just thinking, actually, you say you stay in Cape Town. You're about to go, because this show is going to Monte Cassino, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you're going to run up there.
Yeah.
You've got a family, haven't you? So it must be fairly difficult for you to get away on these theatre tours, or isn't it?
Well, quite often they want me to get away. You know,
shame, actually.
They don't want me around, so.
I'm sure you're joking, yes.
Well, look, my wife's a teacher, and when term starts, it gets immersive. It's hectic. So, actually, we don't really see much of each other anyway.
Because she's away all day and you're away all night.
You know. And it's quite nice sometimes just to be in your own little space and to be able to think about other things and out of the routine of the everyday.
Mm-hmm. And when you come out of a show like this, which is intense and it's got a fairly long run here and in Johannesburg, does it take a while to sort of come down from the whole concept and the whole world of Agatha Christie?
Once the run is finished.
When it's finished.
Yes, I guess it does. But the other part of that is that once it's running and it's fine and it's all working, you relax. And so you get back into sort of a normal routine.
A normal life,
and then you can start
yes.
planning other productions.
Have you got another production lined up?
Well, yeah, I've got something that started a couple of years ago. And it's another solo show. And it started quite by chance, actually. There were three of us from Durban in Cape Town, one of us had two mini exhibitions, fine art exhibitions. He's also a performer, Aldo Brinkat. Aldo and Rajesh Gopi from Durban and I were sitting having lunch in the Company Gardens after Aldo's exhibition. And we were talking, what came up in conversation was family stories. And for instance, one thing that's always made me wonder about being the storyteller is there a responsibility attached to holding on to these old family stories? Sometimes not so old. But if you've been told something and you're the only person that still remembers that story, where is the responsibility? And what do you do with it?
Ooh.
It's an interesting question.
Yeah, it is. Because there's not a clear answer, actually.
No. And does it matter? And you'll find in families, some families will say, no, it doesn't. You move on. Mm. You know, but as a storyteller, I feel like I do have a responsibility. And there's certain stories that always floated to the top of conversation. So the letter that was always left in the bottom drawer of my granddad's study, for example, that was from family we have forgotten about. Nobody knows them anymore. From Ireland, from Belfast. But it was a watershed moment in the family because this old guy was a butcher and he was fleet of foot. He could catch a sheep. He could leap a five-bar gate.
Wow.
Apparently, a leap of five-bar gate. And he went to the market one day. And in those days, butchers wore their knives attached to their apron strings.
Yes.
And he was chasing a sheep, and he fell on his knife, and the knife killed them.
Oh, my goodness.
And the family were left pretty much destitute. This was 1860-something. The letter was there, obviously, because it meant a lot to the family. For generations afterwards, the family were affected by this one incident and this story. My gran was also from Irish stock, and she was the storyteller, you know.
Yes, she used to talk about her life in Joburg as well, growing up in Joburg, and the story of the half crown that her father's best friend gave to her. And it was the first time she held money of her own.
Wow.
She kept it out of sight, and yeah, under her pillow. She never let anyone see it.
So it's a silly little story about a half crown, but it tells you a lot about who she was and how she was growing up in Joburg at the time. And then there's the story of my mother who had an aneurysm when she was 49 and major operation to try and sort this aneurysm out. And when she became conscious, she was a 15-year-old girl again. And when she was looking at me, she saw her brother and she was in 1952, you know, for weeks. That was uncanny. And I thought, okay, so getting back to these two performers who were saying, guys, we need to write these things down. And we are responsible for these stories. We need to tell the stories in the way that we know how. So Aldo started telling his, and he's a very physical actor, and he's got magic tricks and that sort of thing. So he started telling his story about growing up in Durban and where his parents came from, Egypt and Malta. And Rajesh was telling his stories about his auntie who came from India, and who knew how to make these rotis that looked like dolphins. Where did you see dolphins, for goodness sake? We booked a hall, the Erin Hall, for a cold read with an audience. And it was half an hour each, and it worked a treat. And then we've all gone on to start expanding. So now I have this 50-minute show, and I've been to three different places with it, and I've had test audiences in a sense, and I need to get back into telling the story. The interesting thing is those very questions arise for the audience. You know, oh, we remember our story. Yeah. I had an uncle like that.
Yes.
And so afterwards, after the show, people are sitting. They don't get up and leave. They're remembering, you know, which is quite special.
Yeah, it is.
And they're talking to each other about that.
And to you, I dare say.
Yeah, of course.
This next piece of music has a family connection, doesn't it? John Martin, You Don't Know What Love Is.
Well, this is a special connection because the top of the story and the end of the story, Circle Song, is about the first real date of my mother and my father. And my father's coming along in his old silver Vespa to fetch my mum standing in the rain, in the Durban rain, with her best dress outside the Catholic ladies' boarding house. And this is what plays as an end piece.
You don't know what love is. until you know the meaning of the blues. Till you love the love you had to lose. You don't know what love is. You don't know how lips hurt until you've kissed and had to pay the cost. Until you flipped your heart and found you lost. You don't know what love is. You know how a lost heart feels. The very thought of reminiscing. And how those lips that taste of tears.
John Martin. That was called You Don't Know What Love Is, and thank you for that lovely introduction. Ashley Downs is my guest on this week's edition of People of Note, brought to you by Peter Tureen Productions. And in fact, Peter Tureen is the person who's put on this Agatha Christie play called Black Coffee, which has just opened at the Theatre on the Bay. And really, you'll be guessing. I wonder if you'll ever get it right till the end and be astonished. So it's well worth going to see. And Ashley plays the part of Hastings alongside Alan Committee's Poirot. But you know, I was just thinking, and while we've been chatting as well, Ashley, you've done a lot of things, haven't you? Did you always want to be an actor when you were a young man back in Durban?
Yeah, I think so. I remember a particular time when, you know, people often ask, when was it that you first started thinking about it?
And that was sort of what I was going to ask.
Yeah, and it was a very rough introduction to the theatre because literally I was accosted on a corridor at school by the first team prop who didn't want to be in the school play. And I was the first junior that he saw walk past, and he grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and he threw me into the hall and he said, rehearsals are starting. You're taking my place. Okay. And it was a play called Unman, Wittering and Zygo, which was, it was set in a classroom about the murder of a teacher, which all the school kids loved.
I'm sure so they did.
I did that show and I just remember feeling, I couldn't put my finger on it, but I just remember feeling the exhilaration of it. And I thought, oh, there's something about this that I really love. I took detours after that. I mean, a couple of years later, I wanted to be a farmer and I went to a farm school in Moy River. I went to Western Agricultural College, but it just so happened that someone headed me off at the pass. There was an English teacher who was also a published poet, and he was directing the school plays at Western Agricultural College.
Oh.
Very small pond of thisps.
I'm sure, but still, it sounds like it was meant,
yes,
in the air.
So by the time I left Western Agricultural College, I knew I wanted to act. Parents wanted me to do something proper. So I did my degree and I had a teaching diploma as well. So I did start teaching for a while.
Okay.
Before I went in and then segued into the Playhouse Company.
In Durban, yeah, there as well.
Yeah.
Okay. But you've been rather successful, Ashley, may I say, because you've done all sorts of genres, haven't you? You've done television. You told me that you were a continuity announcer on SABC 3 years ago, and you've been in international films.
Yeah.
As well as on the stage.
Yeah.
And television films, TV roles.
Yes. I mean, Joburg was all about scandal, soapy studios. And, you know, I moved to Joburg from Durban because I'd wanted to be in television. Sat around for a long time waiting for work. And then finally this audition arrived for a continuity presenter, which saved my bacon, really, for about 3 years.
Oh, right.
And then I got a co-production in an American series called Scout Safari, and I was terrible. I didn't even want to watch it anymore, but more than paid the bills. It was the best contract that I'd ever seen in my life. So that was lovely. And then I got some travel series. I did some environmental travel series. I did Going Nowhere Slowly, which was a travel show with the big red car, the 65 Chevy Impala. So it introduced me to a lot of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But
the environment is important to you, isn't it? You were just saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Still, to this day.
I think that's one of the big reasons why I've moved down to Cape Town too, because I just love being near the mountain and the sea, you know. And I just feel it's a salvation for me to be able to get away from this traffic and get away from, and you know. And it's, I feel it's important that we can actually do that. We have to do that. So I read a lot of people like Robert McFarlane, who writes a lot about walking. Mm-hmm. He's a Cambridge don who lectures in the literary department, but he also straddles that divide between literature and environment. So he also lectures in the environment. Incredible writer. Beautiful. Underland is one of the last books that he wrote. There's a book coming out now called The River, I think. He does these epic hikes into the Scottish mountainsides, but also just interesting way of encountering characters along the way.
Mm.
And one of his best friends was a guy called Roger Deakin, who was also quite an eccentric, swam all the waterways around the British Isles. So he's got this book called Waterlog, which is fantastic.
Right.
You know, just finding the old waterways that people used to swim,
yes,
old maps,
yeah,
hidden now, grown over, But he'll go and he's passed now. But he was famous for buying this old, dilapidated Elizabethan house with a moat around it. And he rewilded the moat, for example, put all the chochas and the frogs back into it. And so I just love that. And I'm.
Do you get a chance here to walk a lot as well?
I do, yeah. Even if it's just close, close to home, I can walk up on Signal Hill.
Yes. Is that got anything to do with your next piece of music, Sam Lee's The Nightingale?
Well, this is interesting. This is interesting because I came across Sam Lee because I listen to lots of podcasts. And Sam Lee, to put it in context, is a folk singer. He's been collecting folk songs from around the UK for a long time. And it's a dying out tradition. Mm-hmm. A lot of the old folk singers are literally dying out. And he's now this conduit. And he's started to sing these old songs. And one of the things he discovered was the fact that you can have this interaction with nightingales. Whether it's anthropomorphic or not is a very interesting question. I mean, this whole concept of what consciousness is intrigues me as well. Are you just being silly? Are you anthropomorphizing the octopus when you talk about the octopus teacher? What about whale song? Can you play back to whales, which people do? Sam Lee has site-specific performances where he sings folk songs and he brings a cellist with him. And they interact with this little region in southeast England, in around Suffolk, where these nightingales come and sing at night, which is such a special thing. And it's not the first time it happened. There was a cellist by the name of Beatrice Harrison. She was practicing in her garden, and she noticed these birds were interacting with the notes of the cello, and they were singing above it. And it became this thing that she was desperate to share with people, and she invited the BBC in to come and record. And so they made a feature of Beatrice Harrison.
Well, she was famous, wasn't she? With the Elgar Cello Concerto, I think, also with Jacqueline Dupre.
Beatrice Harrison was the first to record the Elgar.
That's what it was.
And
we're going to talk about the cello in a moment,
yes,
because there's a cello in your life, isn't there? In a sense.
Yeah.
But first of all, let's listen to Sam Lee's The Nightingale.
Thank you.
Well, that was called The Nightingale. Sam Lee was responsible for that from his folk song collection. Apparently, he started in 1905 collecting folk songs.
I think that particular folk song was from 1905.
Okay.
He's quite a young man, actually.
Oh, is Sam Lee? Okay. Yeah. My guest is Ashley Dowd. And although we're supposed to be talking about Black Coffee, which we have spoken about, the Agatha Christie play, I mentioned mischievously just now the cello. And do you play the cello? Do you own a cello? Do you
love the cello? I do love it. And they say it's the closest to the human voice, apparently.
Yes.
I did try and play it. I was determined to play it by the time I got to 40. It didn't work. I decided I'd find a cello teacher in my neighborhood in Joburg, in Kensington. If I could find someone, I'd buy a cello and I'd start. And I did find a teacher. His name was Misha Kustanovich. He was very good friends with the maestro at the Playhouse, by the way, who I would have met back in the day in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what happened was I would be terrified because he was quite a forbidding man quite often. I would sweat, I would shake. Very difficult to learn the cello at an older age.
Mm,
you know, you have to grow like a willow around it. But the lessons became stories as well. So I used to journal some of the stories, and it was like half lesson and half story. And the stories would go into all sorts of things. Jacqueline Dupré, we would start talking about the Minsk Conservatoire that he studied at, and the Soviet Union at the time, the stories of him trying to get his cello out of the Soviet Union, initially to Israel, to the Jerusalem Orchestra, and then eventually got to Durban, which was fascinating. But I was thinking about this the other day. I went back to that journal and I thought, there's so many stories here.
You are a story collector, aren't you? Stories fascinate you, clearly.
Because the story is also very related to the character and to the person, related to identity and place and all sorts of things. So someone came to see Elvis Dupuzani and she said, why don't you go and play it at the Shul in Cape Town? And I said, what? The Shul? No, go and have a look. And then I realized it was the decommissioned one at the museum that they have,
which is a
beautiful, resonant space. And while I was standing there, I thought, you know, a cellist and a storyteller in that space would be phenomenal. So that's another another digression.
That's going to come, is it? Can we expect something?
I would love to. I mean, I need to find the right person. And when, you know, I've chosen for the last piece, Jacqueline Dupré, to play Cole Nidre.
Yes.
Op 47. Because there's something about the Hebraic litany and the way that it's sung that is so special. Mm. I think it's funny. When I hear Irish song, when I hear Zulu song, and when I hear this kind of Hebrew litany, I feel very stirred. It's inspirational.
Yeah.
And I think it's precious. I
mean, look, you realize you can't take the whole piece because you're going to run out of time. But, I mean, we'll be able to take a good bit of it from the beginning with Jacqueline Dupré. Would you be happy with that?
I would be very happy.
Okay. Just a reminder that Ashley Dowds, my guest on People Who Note This Week, is performing as Hastings in the Agatha Christie play called Black Coffee, which is on at the Theatre on the Bay. So do go along and see it. It is a special night at the theatre, I can assure you. And Ashley, thank you very much for sharing so many. And you're a storyteller, clearly, and you will remain one.
Thank you, Rodney. Thanks for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure being here. Yeah.
Let's listen to part of Cole Nidre with Jacqueline Dupré. Thank you. People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions. FMR.